We've been talking about the Bible, a book used in a number of interesting ways, most of them probably not what the authors had in mind. There is the coffee table Bible, beautifully bound, untouched, meant to send a signal that this is a Christian family. There is the Bible bound in white leather, and given as a graduation gift or carried down the aisle at a wedding. I've never surprised anyone actually using one of these. I suppose they get put away with the tassel and the wedding gown as part of the memorabilia of happy times. There is the oversized Bible, often used for display on a lectern, too bulky for ordinary use, but a nice symbol of our respect for the book, or perhaps more than that, a kind of charm without which our room would not be complete. But even when the Bible is read, it can be read in a way that is close kin to magic and superstition. Some time ago, a group of college students in Wichita decided to do a 78-hour Bible reading marathon in their church. The entire membership met with them at the start to read the first chapter of Genesis out loud in unison. They came back several days later at 11:30 p.m. to read in unison the last verses of Revelation. In between, more than 75 students took turns reading the Bible aloud, straight through, with no breaks. According to the director of religious education at the church, the marathon was suggested to the kids as an encouragement to, and I'm quoting now, do something of a spiritual nature during the Christmas holidays. Apparently, it did not occur to him that making gifts for children who would otherwise not have any, or visiting neglected people who feel their loneliness most at Christmas, might have provided more spiritual benefit than the stunting with the Bible. But giving gifts, or talking to the lonely, or reading to the blind would have been less dramatic, and would probably have gotten no publicity, whereas this story came to my notice through the newspaper. I suppose what the kids did was no more harmful than packing a phone booth, but I can't imagine that it did much for biblical understanding or the enrichment of character. It is this use of the Bible, as if it were a kind of magic, effective quite apart from meditation and insight, that I am calling talismanic. A talisman is a stone or a ring or some other kind of object thought to possess occult power in its physical essence, and therefore worn as a charm. The Bible exists for a great many people just that way, as a kind of amulet which they like having somewhere around them, so long as they do not have to struggle with its ideas. They simply feel that in some vague, nice way, the presence of this book blesses the house. And even more so, if it is a King James Version with 350-year-old language, which cannot be easily read or understood, particularly in the Old Testament. Maybe this is to be expected, since a talisman seems to be valuable in direct proportion to its mystery. It's very easy to show how much clearer and easier to read the modern versions are But the person to whom the Bible is a talisman only smiles and says, "I'm sorry, but they just don't sound like the Bible." And the word used betrays exactly how this person feels. He speaks not of meaning, but of sound. The Bible has a special sound, antique, old-fashioned, a sound he has come to associate with God and religion. He doesn't know that the sound he likes was not in the Bible as it was originally written, that it is a result of the special rhetorical patterns of 16th century Shakespearean English and the King James translation. What sounds like the Bible is an accident of English history which has come to function as a kind of incantation, a melody of words which soothe and comfort whether or not they make clear sense. People who keep the Bible around as a talisman almost never seriously engage themselves with what it means. But this is not necessarily conscious or deliberate. Often they try, they find it difficult, and they simply give up. They may even feel a subconscious dread of studying the Bible analytically, the way we'll be doing soon on Wednesday nights in this church, for fear that if they do, the magic will vanish. I remember a Wednesday night class in another church many years ago in which we decided to study the book of Ecclesiastes, that strange and beautiful poem of tired cynicism, with its view that human life is desperately troubled and confused and that one cannot make much sense of it. It is magnificent poetry. Thomas Wolfe thought it was the greatest piece of poetry ever written. But it can leave you depressed. It is not the gospel of the power of positive thought. Well, right in the middle of our study of that book, one of the church elders suddenly raised his hand and said he did not know there were ideas like that in the Bible, that they upset him, and that he did not wish to go on with the study. I was surprised that night, but I have thought about it since, and I'm convinced now that his instinct for him was probably correct. One should not investigate a talisman. He should simply wear it or keep it somewhere on display. If somebody doubts its efficacy or insults it, he may wish to fight for it, but the last thing he wants to do is to think critically about what it actually is and how it works. My friend, who couldn't bear the message of Ecclesiastes, would have been mortified to have someone enter his home and find it with no copy of the Bible. He would have barred from public office anyone who said she did not believe in it. But to open it up and seriously study it as a storehouse of disturbing ideas, that appalled him. This view of the physical book itself as a kind of magic has been a problem for Protestants ever since the Reformation. It began in what I like to call the Great Substitution. And here's what I mean. To replace the massive authority of the Pope, which they rejected, Protestants found a substitute in the massive authority of Scripture. As the Pope had been infallible in certain of his utterances, the Bible became infallible in all of its utterances. And having that kind of new authority, for the very first time in all the history of the world, its use went off in two directions. Some people studied it with a new kind of diligence and intensity, eager to know what it was and what it meant, while other people, most people, in fact, complemented it by turning it into an amulet, which for all practical purposes they might just as well have worn around their necks. It's this second approach to the Bible which encouraged the kids I talked about earlier to go racing through it from Genesis to Revelation in a religious tour de force, as if the Bible had some mysterious saving or illuminating grace quite apart from comprehending it or meditating upon it. I remember how this kind of thing was encouraged in my childhood when we all wanted to please our Sunday school teachers by being what was called daily Bible readers. If we could hold up our hands to that effect on Sunday mornings, we got a prize. So each day we'd all read a few quick verses from somewhere with little notion of what they meant and no thought at all about them after we finished. I can even recall, and I cannot believe I was unique, I can recall jumping back out of bed when I had forgotten, turning on the light, reading a verse in 5 seconds, and then falling happily back to sleep in the knowledge that I had remained in the nick of time a daily Bible reader. It was to be many years before I came to understand that one verse thought about until it actually colored my mind and changed my conduct was worth 10 years of that other kind of mechanical reading. The Bible, by the way, is not only a talisman for individuals and at home, it is also often one at church. I haven't the least objection to the large Bible which is opened on the lectern in this church or in any other church, but I think that in part it's there because it's felt to exert a beneficent influence simply as a physical presence. No one reads it. It's simply there. Large, imposing, bound in maroon and gold to match the decor. It was a gift from a church that rented space to us for a while, and I am not ungrateful for it. I simply hope it does not function to confirm people in the notion that Bibles somehow confirm a blessing, whether or not they are read and studied. One day last fall, a comment was made in my Bible course at the university about the willingness of church people to repeat phrases from the Bible which they don't understand at all, but which apparently have a kind of magical power to create good feelings. One older man held up his hand and said, I can explain that. Many people go to church the way they go into a museum. They don't expect anything to be really contemporary or alive. Everything is stylized. And even if they don't understand a word of the ritual, they still feel they've had a kind of cleansing in the museum. We agreed that if this is so, it's not surprising that so many people were willing to put up for so long with a fossilized language that was 3.5 centuries old. Museums, after all, are full of fossils. And it would also explain why people who view a church as a museum instead of a place where the past meets the present in order to ignite a future cannot bear changes, want everything to remain exactly the way it was when they first got acquainted with it. If you were used to seeing an Indian bow and arrow safely resting in a glass cage, and one day you walked in to find a live Indian aiming it at you, it would be unsettling. And the analogy is not a bad one for the difference between King James English and the English of modern versions. In the old versions, you can play safely with the explosive ideas of the Bible because they are all wrapped around with the heavy velvet brocade of Elizabethan English. But when you read the Bible in today's language, in the kind of language in which it was originally written, all of a sudden the ideas become as clear as spring water and as pointed as an arrow. You cannot escape them. For example, in the famous King James translation of 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says of love that it doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. Most readers and auditors get so lost in the old-fashioned TH endings and so lulled by the deliberate rhythms that the ideas do not really penetrate their minds. But listen to the same remarks in the New English Bible. Love is patient. Love is kind and envies no one. Love is never boastful or conceited, nor rude, never selfish, not quick to take offense. Or as Phillips puts it, it is not touchy. And suddenly the famous old words really mean something. And what they mean indicts every one of us. One woman in the class I mentioned earlier said that day, "The truth is that many people really do not want to know what the Bible actually says anyway, because the moment they know for sure, they are saddled with the responsibility to do something about it. They like to hear holy sounds, but they do not want to be upset by demanding ideas." Maybe so. I was certainly tempted to believe her the other day when I looked at a church bulletin someone had brought me from Kansas City. There was a responsive reading in which the minister spoke first, reading a verse from Isaiah. "For thou hast shattered the yoke that burdened them, the collar that lay heavy on their shoulders, the driver's goad, as on the day of Midian's defeat." And then all the congregation replied, "All the boots of trampling soldiers and the garments fouled with blood shall become a burning mass, fuel for fire." Now, I really doubt that anyone in that church had the faintest notion of what all that meant. You could have offered $50 bills to everyone who could identify the day of Midian's defeat and not have lost a week's salary. Could you identify it? The day of Midian's defeat, could you identify it precisely? Well, everybody was going through a ritual without meaning, saying words without significance, rubbing a talisman in their hands. I have dear friends who will do that this morning and feel so good that I feel bad almost even to hint that there could be something better. I have stood in a sanctuary with them at times, with diffused light falling softly through stained glass windows, and recited in unison how all of us long to go up to the temple of Zion and how dearly we love the courts of the Lord. Written by Jewish people, for Jewish people, the words only sound right. They have a biblical ring to them. Ultimately, they are without meaning for most of us who say them. And if we do that long enough, then religion itself becomes divorced from reality, a kind of artifact that belongs in a museum. When the pilgrims put clear glass windows in their congregational churches in New England, they were trying to say what was said in our first prayer on the day we opened this building. That light and clarity are important to us. That we want to understand as much as we want to feel. That will not appeal to everyone, but I hope we can find a balance in this church between emotion and intellect that will nourish anyone who chooses to worship God with us in this room. Next week, on Palm Sunday, we will break from the series on the Bible to talk about the sacrament that almost made it, but failed. And if you can guess what that was before the sermon, your name will be praised in print, and your knowledge, I promise you, will be suitably rewarded. Think about it, if you like, and please be with us again for that day.